Welcome to the latest edition of Fire and Why. You are joining me today on International Women's Day. So congratulations to all those fabulous women out there, both in the University of Oxford, but all our listeners out there in the wider world. As it's International Women's Day, we have decided to go with an international theme today. And I've got three fabulous women from my university here at Oxford who are going to talk about their work in different areas. So with me today, I have from the Department of Surgical Sciences, Professor Kakila Lakou. From the Department of Social Policy and Intervention, I have the Head of Advocacy, Dr. Isang Awa. And from the School of Geography and Environment, I have Professor Katrina Charles. Welcome to you all and happy International Women's Day.
Thank you.
Well, let's start by just hearing a little bit about what you do and what your areas of research are and how they touch on that sort of international space. So maybe, Katrina, I might turn to you first. Tell us a little bit about your amazing work.
I work on water security and particularly improving water security for the poor. So we work across Bangladesh, Ethiopia and Kenya with the REACH program. And we've been doing that since 2015. So it's been quite a long-term research program. And it captures quite a few different aspects of water security. So some of the key areas are improving drinking water in schools and healthcare facilities and for communities. We do work improving access to climate information for water security and work around improving water quality in hospitals.
Fantastic. God, it's extraordinary work. And I really enjoyed being at the celebration you had just recently where all the different colleagues from around the world came back. But maybe I could turn to you now, Kakila, and tell us a little bit about your work in paediatric surgery.
Basically, what I do is capacity building and exchange of skills from a clinical and research perspective in Africa and Southeast Asia. And I've homed into Tanzania. That work is almost 22 years old, and work with research capacity building in Bangladesh.
Fantastic. Well, it's extraordinarily impactful work that you're doing, and I'm keen to sort of get into a little bit more detail. And Isang, tell us a little bit about what you're doing in the Department of Social Policy and Intervention.
I work on advocacy in the Global Parenting Initiative, that is the GPI. And in this role, I work with national governments, UN agencies, NGOs, and faith-based organizations to support the uptake and scale-up of evidence-based playful parenting programs. I also support the national research team. So we have research teams in six countries. We have nine research teams. So I support them. I work with advocacy colleagues to support them in developing and implementing an advocacy strategy for the uptake of evidence-based parenting programs in their different contexts.
Fantastic. God, extraordinary. Well, hopefully already you are as impressed as I am by just what we have around the table from three examples of our wonderful academic women here in the university and what impact they're making globally. I'm very keen to explore what playful parenting is. I'm sure my children would not consider me a playful parent back in the day. Some of the challenges that I think, you know, one will assume you face working on an international stage is the fact that you're Oxford based and you've obviously got research teams here and this is where your sort of academic home is. And yet you need to, again, work in many different countries, as we've just heard. And each country will present different challenges and different abilities for you to probably, you know, conduct your research there, spend time there just on a practical level. Can I just understand a little bit from you how well that works and how you've learnt to juggle those two sort of demands on your time? So maybe, Isang, you could kick off.
So what we've done at the Global Parenting Initiative is that we work collaboratively with different teams. We have teams in different universities and we have partner organizations. So we work with them collaboratively in researching the different aspects of our work and even in working with the governments in this country. So they lead, we provide the support and they lead the work there.
And in terms of the sort of time split, is that something that just varies as projects evolve, or how do you sort of at the outset of a project decide how much time you're going to invest having to be overseas to facilitate that collaboration and to give your contribution, you know, to it in an effective way, not by Zoom?
Sure. Sometimes it's challenging, but we make the effort to go there to meet with the teams. And we also attend conferences together. And so we actually create the time to be there to meet with them. And where there's opportunity, we get the teams to also come over here and work with us.
Right. Okay. In terms of the sort of surgical side of things, I mean, it's a very practical element to that, and there's obviously a huge amount of skill and training that's needed. So can you maybe just talk us through how that works in your world, which is...
Yes, I think I can give an example of how it started for me. In Oxford, in 2002, the Vice-Chancellor from a university in Tanzania came over to look for people that can help them develop specialism, because most basic surgery can be done in country, but anything specialized was traveling to India or South Africa. At that time, I have a full-time job in Oxford. I'm a female and a surgeon. I have two kids under five. And I went home and I said to my husband, I need to go down there to see how it can be done. And he was very, very supportive, which he always is, and said, well, why are you wasting time? Go and join them and see how you can support and help. So I came down to Tanzania and realized that, okay, there's no pediatric surgery here, but they are very well-trained adult surgeons who are doing some of the children's work, and they are pediatricians who know how to look after children. And there was an empty ward which was used for mothers to sleep in. So we converted that ward into a pediatric surgical ward with adult surgeons getting some training and pediatricians working together to look after children. So I took 10 days off my annual leave. I used my own funds to travel, and I did that twice a year. And over 22 years, we have our fully established pediatric surgery departments in 7 centers. We're aiming for 10. We have almost 18 pediatric surgeons there. We have a training program for the past 5 years where we're training our own pediatric surgeons.
Oh, it's extraordinary. I mean, what an amazing legacy. You know, 22 years and to have built up 7 centres aiming for 10. Yeah. But what a sacrifice, you know, and without the support, you know, of your husband and your desire to do this and sacrifice a lot with family holidays with a young family and financially.
Yeah, and I did a lot of, I didn't want to compromise my children, so I did a lot of the work from midnight to 4 in the morning, or would get up at 4 in the morning to put in some work before the children get up. I feel very comfortable that now that my children are young adults, they have not regretted having me as a mother.
I'm sure they're hugely proud of you, hugely proud, and what an amazing legacy. And as you say, the research then followed on once the sort of clinical practice was there. And the Katrine, if I could turn to you and the REACH program, could you just tell us a little bit more about what the sort of origins of that was? How did that come about even? And then how did you build that consensus and collaborative cohort, you know, and consortium to deliver what you're doing? And then maybe just explain a little bit, you know, how does it work on the ground in terms of what you're doing?
Yeah, so the REACH program came about from, well, a group of us who are already working at Oxford around issues on water security. So a couple of years before I joined the university as well, there'd been a water security risks conference where they, you know, really tried to bring these ideas together. And so when the call came out from what's now Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office, FCDO, that, you know, the team was in a good place. So we had already these collaborations with partners in country in some cases, although some were new. We had and collaborations across the university from different disciplines of people working together on these issues around water security. And so we developed that over the years. And I think these issues of what you do in Oxford versus what you do in country are quite relevant in that. So a lot of it has been about supporting the country teams to develop their capacity to take a leading role in water security in their countries. And so in that, you know, we fly in, but to help facilitate what they need. For those of us who are more senior, that's a very political role now, and what we do and how we travel is based around those needs. Whereas, as you were saying, I mean, it's early in the career when your children are young, but also there are demands on you to go out and do the field work and spend a lot of time in a lab that, you know, we have postdocs who we're supporting to manage those teams, because they're the ones who spend a lot of time in the field working on the methodologies with local partners and developing things on the ground.
How did you go about identifying where to start with where the need was? Obviously, there's a lot of need everywhere. So how do you go about selecting where you can add value, as you say, and not just swoop in, but really use the knowledge and skill sets that you have and then bring that benefit and then do that empowering and then walk away?
I think for water security, it's an issue everywhere. So there's no geographic boundary for that. Yeah. There are political areas that were better to work. But I think one of the ways we've worked is to identify water security observatories where we could focus our interdisciplinary research on dedicated areas and get people working together effectively, because that was one of the challenges to overcome of how you get people from different disciplines to communicate. We chose areas where we thought there were interesting questions of what was going to change over the course of the program that we could start to engage in. But we also started right from the very beginning, working with partners in UNICEF, working with partners in government to work out what was relevant to them. And then that was part of that delicate process of working out where can we add things to this, because we don't have every expertise related to water.
Exactly.
And what do you actually need over a relevant timescale for academics to work on?
You know, maybe historically there's been a temptation to go in and assume we know what it was that we should be fixing, and not doing enough listening and having and creating the forum to learn what is actually needed, and then to know whether they actually have got something to offer. So it sounds like you got that process working well.
And that's one of the things we've been trying to share back with funders as well, that one of the reasons we've been able to do this is because of the long-term funding. So we've been a 10-year research program, which is quite unusual. So we've had time to do that preliminary research, to really to work out where we want to work together with government, work out what their needs are, do the baseline work, and develop models. So in Bangladesh, we've been able to develop our safe pani model for drinking water services in schools and healthcare clinics. We're at the stage now where the government is investing in that. And because of the longevity of the funding and the flexibility of it, we've been able to work with them on that development of the policy and continuing to work with them as advisors as they take this to scale.
Right, that is such a good point. And it's obvious now you mention it, but you know, you've got a particular funding model. Isang, is that similar for you in terms of the funding? Because obviously parenting is a long journey, as we know.
Definitely. And I think the one area that we've really had challenges in humanitarian work that we've been doing. So for the past few years, we have done what we call parenting in crisis. And, you know, typically when there's a crisis, people think of immediate needs like clothing, shelter, and they don't think of parenting support as an urgent need. But when you think about it, parents are so stressed in that moment, and they take out their frustration and the stress on children. So we find out that when we have humanitarian crisis, children are usually the victims of most humanitarian crises. So that's part of the work we've done. Let me start by talking about what we did during COVID. That was in 2020. We did this in collaboration with UN agencies, the WHO, UNICEF, UNODC, and other partners. The Parenting for Lifelong Health team quickly developed parenting tip sheets with simple but very clear tips on, you know, what to do when you're stressed. And we had different teams disseminating the resources all over the world globally. So far, the parenting COVID-19 parenting tips have reached over 210 million people. So we were collaborating with local partners who reach out to NGOs, faith-based organizations, and civil society organizations. 34 governments actually partnered with us and included the tip sheets, the resources in their palliatives, in the things that they were sharing for their citizens. We had it on radio and television in Pakistan and so on. And moving on from that, when we had the conflict in Ukraine 2 years ago, there were some needs that these tip sheets did not address. For instance, child trafficking was a risk. And then child sexual abuse. So we went back, developed new set of tip sheets, and we even had QR codes. So what the UNODC did was, as people were leaving Ukraine, they would share the QR codes to enable them to download it.
Kakil, if I could turn to you, I mean, you know, obviously you must develop lots of sheets for parents because you're a paediatric surgeon. So is a lot of what Isang's saying chiming
Yes,
with you?
It resonates with me a lot. I think the most important thing is to engage people and empower them, because they will say to you, this is our need, and then you build on that need. Language is important, and social media is important. Not a lot of people have televisions in the rural communities. So the most important, they all have mobile phones. What we've done for trauma prevention is to use a mobile phone app, and it gives you information of what to do when the child is injured, where to take them, and which is the best facility close by.
Trina, if I could maybe turn to a slightly different topic, and that is, as I mentioned at the start, we're on International Women's Day today, but because there's just so many fabulous things to celebrate about women, we've been actually hosting events pretty much all week. But one of the things that's really struck me this week that's come out in all these different panel events is the issue of retention. Why are women, having been highly trained with all that skill set and all that investment, leaving the workplace or leaving academia because of a toxic culture or a recognition that when things are being flagged and raised, it's not being dealt with effectively? So I'd love to hear from you all about the challenges you've seen and some of the ways that, again, going forwards, we can help in terms of, you know, the local academics that you're working with.
My experience across the partners we work with and the countries we work with are that there are some very common challenges that academics face So, you know, common challenges around publications, getting money for research, dealing with the university administration, but also, you know, common challenges that women face and the expectations and how they clash with academia. And one of the things that's been really important in building partnerships with the countries is to understand those different challenges in different places, because while there are similarities at that top level, they're quite different when you get down to the drivers for individual academics, individual women at the local level, and how they're managing those local cultural demands. And one of the things, you know, we've had to deal with as, you know, running a international research program is, how do you support women who are working in a very, what's already a very patriarchal sector in the water sector, but then also working in very patriarchal cultures? How do you support them to develop? And unfortunately, sometimes that means leaving the program. But we've had women who have gone on to brilliant further careers, and that's sometimes a great option of going on to particularly international organisations, which are better placed to support women. But it does mean you're still left with that issue.
Yeah, you've not dealt broadly with the causal problem. Really important. Mm. Kapila?
So what the Tanzanians have done is they formed a women's medical society, just from the medical perspective, and talk about these issues, that here we are, we are looked upon as mothers and wives rather than colleagues, you know, in the workplace. Yeah. And how do we change that paradigm? And I think the problem is just not in the low-income countries. It's even in Oxford. Come to a certain level and it feels like a glass ceiling. Mm-hmm. They just can't get ahead because there's no support for that. And I think flexible working hours is one of the best solutions, where you can put your best in if you're allowed to work flexibly around your needs. And that applies across the board internationally.
Now, I was saying, you were nodding your head about the part-time flexibility. I could see
absolutely,
that. But also,
absolutely. First of all, I just want to say I agree with everything that has been said so far. And I really love the idea of women coming together. But, you know, for me, I think the first thing is for us to recognize that there is a problem here. Because sometimes people don't even recognize that there is a problem. Yeah. So I just want to talk about me. You know, I was a stay-at-home mom for a long time. Mm-hmm. And I like to think that if I had the option of working part-time or I was able to work flexibly, that may have been, you know, a choice I may have taken up instead of just resigning from work and looking after my children. So if women, especially in African countries where the culture is really patriarchal, have these options, I think it's a way that we can support them to stay on.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And this, I've often said, you know, why would you not have a fantastic woman for half a day, one day a week, rather than no days a week? You know, have that talent for whatever amount of time you can have that talent, having developed that talent, and that will absolutely help facilitate also, if they wish to, return, you know, in an increasing, you know, volume, you know, to the workplace. But we've just got to get better, and I say that, you know, as Vice Chancellor here, in thinking about how can we be more open, more flexible about how we think about career structures and that part-time flexibility. Often, if I take sort of the local Oxford context, I mean, there is actually a lot more than I think people realise there is in that capacity. So we need to work harder at making sure that that is communicated, but then to really make sure where maybe it's not happening or it's been prevented, that we come down heavy and ensure that, you know, people are able to combine, you know, what is always going to be a difficult patches and pinch points in their careers, combining everything all at once. Sadly, we're coming to the end of our time, but maybe just to finish off, let's discuss some of the more difficult sides of working internationally. Maybe I could start this with you in terms of how you think the good examples of collaborating so that there really is net benefit.
Basically, what we do when we're working with different partners, especially when we're developing resources, we allow them to lead. So it's not like it's not a top-down process. And especially, let me speak about our Parenting in Crisis resources. We have the evidence base. Obviously, we have the content, but we allow them to lead, especially in cultural adaptations. And just like we've discussed earlier, we listen to them, not just in terms of the phrases and the language that we use, but even in designing illustrations or images. I remember, like, when we did the Pakistan parenting resources and we shared with our colleagues, they came back and they said, oh, this doesn't quite work. Tweak tweak the mustache of the man a little bit, change this, change that. So we just allow them this disrespectful collaboration. We allow them to lead. They know what is right for their context. Just working with them in a flexible way is what has led to so much reach. We listen to them and then we take, in terms of what works for their context, we allow them to lead that.
Yeah, no, it sounds good. And in a nutshell, playful parenting in one sentence?
Yeah, playful parenting. It's spending time with your child, deliberately playing with them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's something that we often don't think of as something important.
Yeah.
Allow them to lead in playing. It's not what we want to do. If you want to read and maybe you want to read a storybook to them and they'd rather play football or something in the garden, allow them to do that. Just creating that time to be playful in your parenting.
To be led by what the child wants.
Yes, exactly.
Same way as the collaboration. And Katrina, how about yourself in the reach work? You know, this sort of issue around this ethical tightrope that I think you recognise.
One of the things we're really proud of in the program is when we have our partners tell us that, you know, the minister now listens to them, you know, that their research, their science is being recognised and informing policy locally. And that for us is such a big gain for that country, that they now have a scientist who's trusted in informing policy. And so for us, you know, working with partners in country and building, helping them to build in a way that's useful for them, understanding the pressures they're under too and when this works for them and what doesn't, it's been really successful for us. And I think it's would have been a very different issue if we'd come in and just set up a research centre separately and taken people away from those established institutions. And we see this, we see donors coming in, we see other examples where they haven't realised the impact that it's having, that they're actually perhaps undermining the capacity they're trying to build because they haven't realise the system they're working in and not supporting those systems.
Yeah, that's a really important point. And Kikili, you must have seen this yourself with goodwill, but not necessarily applied in the right way.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is your research questions will come from the ground to empower local people, to mentor them in situations where you need to mentor, to collaborate, but always they are in charge and that's when it becomes successful.
Yeah, no, fantastic. Well, sadly, we've come to the end of our time here, but can I just finish by thanking you, Katrina, and Kikila and Isang for joining me today and just sharing a little bit about your work. I hope that that's inspired everybody to not just be feeling very proud of what our wonderful academics here are doing on a global level, but to go and find out a little bit more about them. And if you feel that there is areas that you'd like to collaborate with, then I'm sure you'd be very open for people to reach out to you. So best of luck going forwards with everything that you're doing. I'm very proud of all the work that you are contributing. And thank you again for joining us on Far and Wire. And I look forward to joining colleagues and friends at the next episode next term.